Welcome to the debate. You know, usually when we look at how a rights movement tries to topple the status quo, we picture a siege.
Right.
There is a fortress out there. Maybe it's a corrupt government ministry or, you know, a specific discriminatory law.
Or a greedy corporation.
Yeah, it's an external target.
Exactly.
You rally your troops, you surround the castle, and you knock the walls down. It's a very clean us versus them dynamic.
Right. It's very cinematic.
But when you dive into the sociology of gender equality, that whole siege model just kind of falls apart. Because the battlefield isn't a castle miles away, it's your own dinner table.
Yeah.
It's the living room, the marriage, the workplace. Yeah,
it's the ultimate inside job, really. You are forced to negotiate with the exact people you share a life with.
Which brings us to a really tough strategic question today. When a movement is fighting for equality inside those intimate spaces, do you, you know, catch more flies with honey? Or do you need to just flick the table?
Right.
In other words, in a modern democracy, should feminist movements prioritize building coalitions and playing nice, or should they lean into confrontation and make things profoundly uncomfortable?
And just to be clear on what we're actually debating here, we aren't talking about physical violence.
No, of course not.
In a modern democracy with a free press, violence just takes you off the board entirely. So when I say a movement needs to be confrontational, I'm talking about adversarial framing. Naming and shaming.
Causing friction.
Yes, causing real social friction and forcing a public reckoning where you treat the unconvinced audience not as a friend, but as an opponent who is actively holding up progress.
And on the flip side, when I argue for a conciliatory approach, I don't mean just sitting back and quietly waiting for things to get better. I mean focusing entirely on persuasion and coalition building, framing the unconvinced as potential partners.
Mm-hmm.
You can still create massive disruption, which, you know, we'll get into later, but you do it without treating the other side as the enemy.
Right. And my stance is that if you want to actually fix normalized, deep-seated societal problems, confrontation isn't just an option. It's a sociological requirement.
Okay.
You have to force people to look at the invisible harms they're ignoring.
And I'll be arguing that because these issues touch our most intimate relationships, coming in with a wrecking ball just triggers a massive backlash. If you want structural change, you have to ruthlessly protect those bridges, not burn them.
Well, let's just jump straight into the biggest flaw with that build bridges approach then. Because the whole idea assumes you have an audience that actually wants to sit down and listen.
Well, not that they are eager to listen, just that they are the everyday people we interact with. I mean, society itself is the audience.
But society is actively designed to hide the harm. Think about what gender inequality actually looks like on the ground.
Okay.
We're talking about domestic violence that literally happens behind closed doors. We're talking about workplace harassment buried under, you know, non-disclosure agreements and just corporate culture.
Right. It's institutionalized.
Or even just unequal caregiving at home, which society just kind of shrugs off as the way things are. These harms are completely privatized. They are invisible to the public eye.
Yeah.
So if your strategy is just being polite and non-adversarial, you're trying to solve a problem people don't even admit exists.
I hear that, but how does starting a fight solve the visibility problem?
By creating friction. Sociologically, confrontation forces a public reckoning. When you cause public discomfort, when you name and shame bad actors, you are ripping the roof off the house and forcing the public to look inside.
Okay.
You cannot persuade an unengaged public. You have to disrupt them first.
Okay, let's follow that logic. You rip the roof off the house, you name and shame. Who are you actually shaming? This is what I call the coalition necessity problem. You aren't attacking some faceless corporation. The opponents you are alienating are often the very fathers, partners, employers, and, you know, local legislators that the movement desperately needs to eventually pass family leave or elect new leaders.
So we should just pretend everything is fine so we don't hurt their feelings?
It's not about their feelings. It's about their leverage. Look, if a civil rights campaign wants to end a discriminatory housing policy, they can just defeat the city council. They don't need the city council's friendship.
Right.
But a movement trying to change how domestic labor is divided or how families are structured, the electorate's private, everyday choices literally are the reform. You can't alienate the people whose cooperation you need to sustain the change.
See, you're prioritizing the comfort of the negotiating partner over the actual leverage of the movement. Let's look at how political change actually happens historically. Let's talk about the 1910s and the American suffrage movement.
Oh, perfect example, because that era proves exactly why coalition building works.
Does it?
Yeah, you had two completely different playbooks running at the exact same time.
Right. You had Alice Paul on one side,
who is purely confrontational. She breaks away, forms the National Woman's Party, and they go highly adversarial. Picket lines outside the White House, getting arrested, staging hunger strikes in prison.
Absolute maximum friction.
Right? Maximum friction. And on the other side, you had Carrie Chapman Catt leading NASA, which was the mainstream movement.
The polite ones.
The strategic ones. Catt launches our winning plan in 1916, and it is a masterclass in conciliatory strategy. She completely ignored the states that were historically hostile, focused all her resources on state-level coordination where she could actually build majorities, and engaged in patient, nonpartisan lobbying.
Okay, but
she didn't shame politicians. She gave them off-ramps. And by 1920, who actually secured the final votes for the 19th Amendment? It was Catt's methodical, coalition-first approach that got those unpersuaded legislators to finally sign on the dotted line.
Hold on. You're giving Carrie Chapman Catt all the credit for closing the deal, but you're completely ignoring the elephant in the room.
Which is what?
Catt only looked like a reasonable negotiating partner because Alice Paul was out there chaining herself to the gates.
You think Catt's lobbying only worked as a contrast?
It's not just what I think. It's a foundational mechanic in sociology. Have you ever looked at Joe Freeman's work from the 70s? The radical flank effect?
Right. The idea that the extremists basically act as a foil for the moderates.
Exactly. Think of it like price anchoring when you buy a car.
Okay.
If a dealer starts by asking for $100,000, suddenly $50,000 sounds like a total bargain.
Right, sure.
In movement politics, the radical wing shifts the baseline of what society considers reasonable. Freeman looked at the women's liberation movement and realized that the moderates only get invited into the room when the establishment is terrified of the radicals outside.
So you're saying the tension is the point?
Yes. We see this everywhere. Look at civil rights in the 60s. Corporate and foundation funding to moderate organizations actually skyrocketed precisely when the confrontational Black Power movement started gaining visibility.
Because the establishment needed a safe alternative?
Yes. Conciliation doesn't work in a vacuum. It only gains traction with entrenched power structures if a confrontational wing forces the issue and creates that massive friction first. So telling a movement to just be conciliatory is backward. You need the radicals to open the door.
That analogy of price anchoring is clever, but it treats the radical flank effect like it's an absolute law of gravity, and it's not.
How so?
Because if you push the price anchor too high, the buyer doesn't negotiate. They just walk off the lot.
Well,
no, really. The empirical data actually shows that when tactics cross into severe hostility, it actively damages the moderate wing. It doesn't make them look reasonable. It tanks the whole brand.
I'm not sure I agree it tanks the whole brand.
It absolutely does, which brings us to the biggest vulnerability of confrontation in a modern democracy: backlash elasticity.
Meaning the movement's inability to control its own narrative.
Precisely. In a system with a free press and elections, you don't control the camera angles. The opposition gets a vote too.
Sure.
If you hand them visible, confrontational behavior, they will stretch it, they'll warp it, and they will weaponize it to destroy your coalition. We saw this exact dynamic utterly dismantle the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s.
The ERA fight is fascinating because of how fast it flipped.
It was a political whiplash. I mean, picture the early 70s. The ERA passes Congress with overwhelming bipartisan support.
Right.
By 1977, they have 35 of the 38 states they need for ratification. It was the product of brilliant, conciliatory, polite lobbying, and then Phyllis Schlafly enters the chat.
With her Stop ERA campaign.
Right. And Schlafly didn't just argue policy. She weaponized adversarial framing against the movement. She took the most radical, confrontational voices of second-wave feminism and held them up to middle America.
Yeah, the scary radicals.
Exactly. She told housewives, look at these radicals. They aren't trying to get equal pay. They are trying to destroy the traditional family. They want to draft your daughters. They want to take away your alimony.
Which was highly effective.
It was incredibly effective. She took the friction you love so much, and she used it to build a massive counter-coalition that stopped the ERA dead in its tracks. It failed three states short.
It's a tragic loss, obviously.
But it proves the point. Visible confrontation gives opponents the exact B-roll footage they need to fabricate a radical frame. If you stick to a conciliatory strategy, you starve the opposition of the material they need to generate a backlash.
Okay, that sounds really logical on paper, but look a little closer at your own example. Did Phyllis Schlafly actually defeat the ERA by reacting to specific confrontational tactics by feminist organizers?
I mean, she used their rhetoric.
No, she reframed the entire concept of women's rights as an attack on the family. She didn't need actual footage of radicals burning things down to make her point.
But she capitalized on the cultural anxiety they created. If they had been more moderate.
Sure, but she was going to invent that anxiety regardless. In a modern media environment, opponents are going to fabricate an adversarial frame, no matter how perfectly polite you are.
You think it wouldn't have mattered?
Not at all. They don't need you to chain yourself to a fence. They'll go on television and say, asking for equal pay is an attack on the nuclear family.
Well?
No, think about it. You are asking movements to preemptively disarm themselves, to abandon the very tactics that raise visibility, all to prevent a backlash that bad faith opponents are going to manufacture anyway.
But there's a difference in scale, right? Fabricated outrage is one thing. It has a short half-life.
Does it?
Yes. But outrage backed up by daily footage of confrontational activists disrupting people's daily lives? That solidifies. That turns into a permanent electoral defeat. You can't just brush that off.
Then let's talk about the actual cost of avoiding that footage. You're advocating for patience. Let's do state-by-state coordination. Let's do incremental legislative lobbying. That ERA fight you just mentioned?
Yeah.
From a structural level, is who actually pays the price for that patience?
The movement puts in the grueling work. The organizers.
No. The victims pay the price. By demanding a slow, conciliatory strategy, you are essentially telling people who are suffering from ongoing systemic harm right now. Women facing workplace discrimination, domestic abuse, completely unequal legal standing.
I'm not saying they should just suffer.
But you are. You're telling them to quietly absorb that harm for another 20 years. You are asking the victims to bear the cost of patience just so we don't make some persuadable, privileged voter uncomfortable.
That's a mischaracterization of what conciliatory means.
It isn't, though. That isn't just bad strategy. Sociologically, it is a profound injustice. Confrontation takes the discomfort off the victim and forces it onto the society that is allowing the victimization.
That is a really powerful moral argument, and I hear the urgency. I truly do.
Thank you.
But strategically, you're falling into a false dichotomy. You're equating conciliatory with being quiet. You're assuming that if we aren't screaming at the opponent, we're just sitting in a waiting room hoping they change their minds.
If you aren't creating friction, what are you doing? How do you force change without conflict?
You can create massive, systemic disruption without being adversarial. Let me give you my absolute favorite historical countermodel. Iceland, October 24th, 1975. The Women's Day Off.
Oh, the famous 1975 strike.
Ah, see, you called it a strike.
Well, that's what it was, wasn't it?
But that is the absolute strategic genius of what they did. They specifically refused to call it a strike.
Why? Because of the legal trouble with the unions?
Partly legal, yes, but mostly sociological. In 1975, an estimated 90% of women in Iceland just walked away from their jobs and their homes for one day. Bank clerks, factory workers, teachers, stay-at-home mothers, they all just stopped.
Wow.
The country was completely paralyzed. You had male bank executives trying to cook sausages for their kids in the office because the schools and daycares were closed. The scale of the disruption was absolute.
Right, they brought the country to its knees.
Exactly. But the organizers rigorously framed it as a day off. They deliberately stripped all the adversarial union strike language out of it. They didn't point fingers at men and say, you are the enemy.
So what was the framing then?
They framed it purely as a positive demonstration of women's indispensable value to the economy.
A subtle rebrand.
But a rebrand that changes everything. The achieved urgent, massive disruption. But by using purely conciliatory framing, they completely short-circuited the backlash elasticity. The men couldn't get mad without looking ridiculous. They were forced to just acknowledge how much they relied on women's labor.
Because there was no villain to fight.
Yes. You don't have to choose between moral urgency and relationship building. If your political framing is sophisticated enough, you can stop the machine without making the machine hate you.
It is a brilliant moment in history. I mean, the imagery alone is incredible. The guy is trying to cook the sausages in the bank.
It's amazing.
But let's push back on how reproducible that actually is.
Why wouldn't it be? Because Iceland in 1975 was a tiny, highly homogeneous society. Try organizing 90% of any demographic across a massive, polarized democracy like the US or the UK today. It's logistically impossible.
Well, it's harder, certainly.
It's entirely different. And even in Iceland, the day-off framing only worked because the latent threat of total economic collapse was staring everyone in the face.
But it was still a velvet glove approach. They didn't burn the banks down.
Yes, but there was an iron fist inside it. The velvet glove was the day-off branding, but the fist was the complete paralysis of the country. It was confrontation wearing a conciliatory mask.
I think that's a stretch. It was peaceful.
Peaceful, yes, but economically violent. The men of Iceland only saved face because the women essentially held the economy hostage. That is structural confrontation.
But it didn't trigger a backlash. That's the key difference.
Because it was over in a day and they won. But when you're dealing with deeply privatized harms, you can't always organize a nationwide day off. Sometimes you just have to call out the bad actors. You have to make the invisible visible. And that fundamentally requires a level of friction that a polite, conciliatory framework just tries to gloss over.
I think we've perfectly mapped the tightrope that strategists have to walk here. To synthesize where we've landed, from my perspective, because these gender dynamics are so intimately woven into our families, our marriages, and our workplaces, movements really have to protect their framing.
Mm-hmm.
Opponents in a modern media ecosystem are desperate for that B-roll footage of angry radicals to fuel their backlash. So while you need disruption, wrapping it in conciliatory, coalition-building frameworks, like Iceland did, is the only way to keep the electorate at the table for the long haul.
In synthesizing my end, the fundamental sociology of these issues is that normalized harms are invisible to the public. They demand confrontational friction just to be seen.
Right.
If you rely entirely on patient coalition building, you're unjustly shifting the burden of waiting onto the people who are actively suffering. Plus, if we look at the radical flank effect, the moderates only get their power because the confrontational wing kicks the door open first.
But we definitely converge on just how complicated a free press makes all of this. Movements don't happen in a vacuum. Every single protest, every single lobbyist meeting is refracted through the media and interpreted by the public.
Completely. Managing the tension between the moral urgency to stop harm right now and the strategic patience required to actually build a lasting majority. It's really the hardest puzzle in politics.
It is.
You can't pass laws without majorities, but you can't get people out of their chairs without urgency.
Which is why digging into the mechanics of these historical moments is so valuable. The source material is full of these incredible case studies showing how movements navigate these exact structural landmines. It really forces you to ask hard questions about how change actually happens.
It really is that history of trying to figure out exactly which lever to pull, especially when the machine you're trying to fix is actively fighting you.
It is. And we'll leave you, the listener, to decide which approach actually gets the job done. Because when the battlefield isn't a distant fortress, but your own living room, figuring out how to rebuild the house without burning it down is the ultimate strategic test.
Or maybe figuring out when a little fire is exactly what you need to finally see in the dark.